since he walk as existence. What does it mean to exist, to be? And to bring our attention to the property of being is also to bring simultaneously our attention to the property of experience. That is, it can be experienced.
Could you repeat just the sentence, please, one more time?
I said, when we are talking about being, we have to think about experience at the same time. That is, if something exists, how can we know that it exists? The only way we know that it exists is because we can experience it. It can exist without our knowledge, but here he's talking about subjective experience. To our subjective mind, the infinity of existence is one symbol. In other words, our subjective experience is only possible if there is something which exists. To subjective experience, existence and the possibility of experiencing go together. If something is truly infinite, there is that in it which can never be experienced. To experience itself is a property of consciousness within being. So we can say that being can represent itself as experienceable. Or not being, but whatever that which goes or transcends being can represent itself as experienceable. That is being. That which is illimitably unmanifest can be. So being is a property of that which is illimitably unmanifest. Its opposite property is non-being. In other words, that which can never be experienced to the subjective mind. The subjective mind can never know it or can never experience it. So it is non-being from that point of view. Infinite, this is the unmanifest reality, that the transcendental infinite, it surpasses being and non-being. That's why it says sat asat rupam. That whose forms are being and non-being. And you can understand this more experientially if you look at it or think about it in terms of the fact that at any point, our subjective reality or subjective consciousness is capable of experiencing reality as something. So whatever this something is, whatever its ambit is, its extent is being to us. If we turn our attention to pure material reality, then the material world is being to us. And that which is outside of it is non-being to us. So always there is a certain way by which we can erase whatever we can experience. This is the essence or the reality or the truth of the nirvanic experience. Nirvana affirms the fact that to any experience of being, there can be a greater non-being. But Advaita sort of affirms the fact that to any experience of non-being, there can be a greater being. So we are talking about two infinities, two successions. To grow in experience is to grow in greater and greater access to being, to infinite being. And it opens us to a vista of infinite being. But simultaneously, we realize that in this growth, there is a constant surpassing, which consists of erasing whatever we know to be being. And in that, we open up a vista of infinite non-being. So being and non-being are two infinites that coexist in the description of that which transcends or surpasses being and non-being. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so you know what I was thinking? Since he uses the word existence, he means becoming rather than being. But maybe it's just, it means similar things here.
No, existence is used synonymously with being. In Sri Aurobindo's terminology, Sat of Satchidananda can be translated as either being or existence.
Which is different from becoming.
Yes, which is different from becoming, or becoming is one of its properties if you look at it from his point of view, but you can also see it as different from becoming. And he splits it, being and becoming, as the duality. You would say, if you use the term existence, existence is being over there.
Okay, got it. So existence is Sat and non-existence, or that is Asat.
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, shall we start the reading?
Yeah, let's start the reading.
Starts from that is a precisely opposite, right?
Yes.
There is a precisely opposite view of reality and knowledge, which affirms an objective reality as the only entire truth, and an objective knowledge as the sole entirely reliable knowledge. This view starts from the idea of physical existence as the one fundamental existence, and the relegation of consciousness, mind, soul, or spirit to the position of a temporary outcome of the physical energy in its cosmic action. If indeed soul or spirit has any existence. All that is not physical and objective has a lesser reality dependent on the physical and objective. It has to justify itself to the physical mind by objective evidence on a recognizable and verifiable relation to the truth of physical and external things, before it can be given a passport of reality. But it is evident that this solution cannot be accepted in its rigor, as it has no integrality in it, but looks at only one side of existence, even only one province or district of existence, and leaves all the rest unexplained, without inherent reality, without significance. If pushed to its extreme, it would give to a stone or a plum pudding a greater reality, and to thought, love, courage, genius, greatness, the human soul and mind facing an obscure and dangerous world and getting mastery over it, and an inferior dependent reality, or even an unsubstantial and evanescent reality. For in this view, these things so great to our subjective vision are valid only as the reactions of an objective material being to an objective material existence. They are valid only in so far as they deal with objective realities and make themselves effective upon them. The soul, if it exists, is only a circumstance of an objectively real world nature. But it could be held, on the contrary, that the objective assumes value only as it has the relation to the soul. It is a field, an occasion, a means for soul's progression in time. The objective is created as a ground of manifestation for the subjective. The objective world is only an outward form of becoming of the spirit. It is here a first form, a basis, but it is not the essential thing, the main truth of being. The subjective and objective are two necessary sides of the manifested reality and of equal value. And in the range of the objective itself, the supraphysical object of consciousness has as much right to acceptance as the physical objectivity. It cannot be a priori set aside as a subjective delusion or hallucination. Should I read the next or should I stop here?
Actually, I have a question.
Wait a minute. I think it is better to stop for a little bit and take up this paragraph and then move to the next one.
The Vishishta.
Yes.
Devashishta, getting lot of echo. Can you just try your microphone again? For some reason, suddenly start getting lot of echo.
No, I think that was because I hadn't muted it. It should be better now.
Okay, I see.
Okay, before any questions, Shyam, maybe I'll just speak a little bit about this paragraph because it introduces another side to the whole discussion that he has been talking about so far, and then we can take questions.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Man, somebody types.
Okay, so far, the various views that Sri Aurobindo has taken up, going back to almost the beginning of our reading, for two or three pages back, the conceptions of reality. He started with an Advaitic view of reality, and then he considered a variety of other conceptions of reality, as he called them. And these conceptions of reality, one of them actually was quite close to this objectivist position. But all of them were really subjectivist positions. In other words, they came from first considering the fact of our presence in the world and our experience and observation of the world as primary. So the question arises as to whether this world that we observe is real at all or not. And the conceptions that he took up had to do with, first, the fact that this world, if it is real at all, is beyond our real understanding. Whatever it is, we can never know. And so our experience of this world is something that is subjectively true only to ourselves. And we can take a variety of stands to that kind of an experience. One is that the sense of entrapment in this experience can be denied through first a denial of the object of our experience, which is after all a subjective object. In other words, the world only exists as a picture inside our own consciousness and mind. And secondly, through a denial of the instrumentation of knowledge. In other words, through both a denial, a double denial of Prakriti and Purusha. Otherwise, the other alternative he took up over there is that it may be seen as a kind of becoming. That is a principle of becoming, whether we call it creativity or we call it some sort of idea of just blind form, creates this universe out of nothing, more or less. And if it creates it out of nothing, that becomes a basis, of course. But if it creates it without any basis, then also we have the fact that it is created with some sort of infinite becoming principle in it, and that itself supposes some kind of being. So these are the arguments, and then the final argument he took up had to do with our experience as being present in a certain field with two infinite ends, a supraphysical and an inconscient end. And these two infinites are both incomprehensible to us and we derive an understanding of this reality through symbols. But then he went on to show that these symbols themselves may be ways by which this, which transcends both the poles, polarities of superphysical and inconscient, is representing itself to itself and manifesting itself through symbolic forms, through real symbols, as we might call it. But all these views that he has considered so far assume the primacy of human consciousness to start with. And then of consciousness with a capital C, impersonal consciousness, as the ground of human consciousness. So we can call them all subjectivist views. Now he has taken, in this one brief paragraph, the opposite side of things as a possible ground or possible basis for explaining reality, and that is a material ground. Objectivity. That is, what we experience or observe has an a priori reality. And this is really the foundation of science, or of that aspect of science, of the philosophy of science, which believes that matter is the ground from which consciousness arises as an accident or as an epiphenomenon. Similarly, we have earlier Indian philosophies also, like the Charvak philosophy, where consciousness is just like a bubble. And we can take a variety of stands on this basis too. One of which is that we can make our approaches to understanding this basic and primordial material reality as truthfully as possible, even beyond the power of our senses, but assuming that it is real, which is one way of understanding a deterministic science that is trying to use its instruments and its mathematics to explain an inexperienceable reality. And the other stand we can take from the viewpoint of our own experience is that of hedonism. That is, since I'm just a nothing, I'm just a bubble that has arisen in this material world, whatever it is, I don't need to bother about it. All I need to bother about is what happiness I can get within this bubble existence. Meaninglessness and the hedonism of the senses so long as they exist. And this ultimately becomes the Charvak philosophy. So these are the kinds of materialistic philosophies which give primacy to the objective material world. And Sri Aurobindo is positing over there the fact that this kind of philosophy is partial, just as he has pointed out earlier, that we have no right to make an assumption on matter as being primal or primary. And so if we don't have that right, if we cannot really claim with any certainty that this is primary, of matter as we experience it, because after all it is experienced inside us, we have to actually give some credence or some truth to subjective experience as well. And so that's the reason why he ends that particular paragraph by showing that the objective assumes value only as it has relation to us, to the soul. So if the soul, not an epiphenomenon of the objective world, is equally possible that the objective world exists for the sake of the soul, a field, an occasion, a means for the soul's progression in time. The objective is created as a ground of manifestation for the subjective. The objective world is only an outward form of becoming of the spirit. It is here a first form, a basis, but not the essential thing, the main truth of being. And then he turns around and gives value to both of them and says, the subjective and objective are two necessary sides of the manifested reality and of equal value. And then he points out that we again have no right to claim that material objectivity is the only form of objectivity there exists just by dint of the fact that we can experience it with our senses. If there is that which goes beyond the physical world of objective forms, that also has equal right of our attention. And so he says, in the range of objective manifested reality, in the range of the objective itself, the supraphysical object of consciousness has as much right to acceptance as the physical objectivity. So this is how he expands the scope of the objective reality, because ultimately it is reality's own becoming, self-becoming of subject and object in the quest of self-knowledge. That is the understanding of manifestation from the point of view of the becoming of knowledge. So this is in brief, what I feel that he does with this particular paragraph and how he connects it to the rest of his descriptions of reality.
So, I have two questions and I think they are both related, so I'll ask them both. Is objective reality another word for physical reality, or does it have more connotations? And the second question is, when we say subjective, when he says subjective, does he mean subjective only to the human consciousness, or does subjective have other meanings as well?
Yes. When he uses the term objective reality, it depends on what are the premises of what we consider to be the valid object of our experience and consideration, of our mentality and experience. So objective reality will, just like the word consciousness, so these are very interesting terms, mm-hmm. will mean something totally different to different people depending on what their belief system is. Mm-hmm. If you go to a scientist and use the word consciousness, they usually mean by it cognitive understanding, understanding limited by mentality. Similarly, if you use the word objective, they mean by it material objectivity. But what Sri Aurobindo is doing over here is he starts with that kind of explanation or description of objective, and then he extends it to say that anything that can be considered or experienced as an object of our experience is objective. And that's why he says objectivity cannot be limited to the world of our senses or the world of our external senses, because we have internal senses as well, and we have experiences that belong to that primordial sense that transcends the five senses. And all these experiences, so long as they can hold an object of experience, are talking about something which is objective. And therefore, the supraphysical world is as objective as the physical world from that point of view. And secondly, as far as subjectivity is concerned, again, it's the same thing. In all these descriptions, as you see, he starts with the human mind as the basis of the subjective. But he goes on to point to a kind of universal subjectivity. The Purusha with a capital P, for example, that backgrounds the many multiple Purushas, or the consciousness with a capital C, which backgrounds the mentality or subjectivity that we have access to in our ordinary existence. As our experience of ourselves as subject expands, we start coming into contact with universal forms of subjectivity and consciousness. And this then gives us the knowledge of subjectivity as an universal reality. So universal subjectivity is something which we cannot maybe posit in our present state of experience, but we cannot deny it unless we experience that it does not exist. And that's the point he is making, that there are states of experience in which we can affirm it. And so subjectivity is not limited to human consciousness, but to universal forms of subjectivity.
Yeah, thank you, Debashishda. So it seems that most of these words, the meanings are much denser than what is used in normal or casual language, right?
Yes, absolutely. He starts with a certain understanding which sort of overlaps with the casual understanding of these things, but then he expands them himself to include and to refine or transform the understanding of these terms.
So let me just get the understanding of a priori right. So a priori means absolute, right? Something that is not related, it doesn't need something else to stand.
Yes, something which doesn't can be posited without any cause to it.
Okay, like not the derivative, the primary.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I have a question. What is the closest term? What is the closest term that comes to subjective and objective? And if we were to use a Sanskrit term, what would be that?
There is not an exact overlap of these terms. So the way he translates these, it is more like Purusha and Prakriti. Prakriti is the domain of objectivity, and Purusha is the domain or is the subject.
So, Debashishda, this thing about Kshetra and Kshetrajna, can we say that Kshetra is the objective and Kshetrajna is the subjective?
Yes, you can say that. In fact, that is the kind of distinction that he is drawing on, most probably as from the Gita, when he says, uses that particular phrase over there, of that part of that sentence, the objective word, where does he say that? It is a field, an occasion, a means for the soul's progression in time, when he is talking about the objective. The objective assumes value only as it has a relation to the soul. It is a field, an occasion, a means for the soul's progression in time. So that use of the word field as the kshetra and soul or purusha, he's using the word soul over there in a kind of a more loose way. We can take it as the psychic being there, but also in a looser way as that which observes and deals with the field, comes to know the field, the kshetrajna. Yes, there is also, you see, Sri Aurobindo has used the term comprehension and apprehension elsewhere. And they also have to do with this notion of the subject and the object. Because in talking about the ways of knowing that ultimately become manifest, talks about that which apprehends reality. And the property of apprehension of that which transcends subject and object produces subject and object. Comprehension is that which includes subject and object in itself, overpasses them. And apprehension is that which projects itself to itself as an object. So in some way, the terminology, even from Sanskrit, is very difficult to map. And in some ways, he goes beyond that terminology. And when we use subject and object in terms of the Western understanding of subject and object, we also can't map it very exactly to Purusha and Prakriti. Because the field of Prakriti includes many things that we consider to be subjective in the Western sense. Intelligence itself, for example, or mentality is part of the objective or objectivity as far as the division between Purusha and Prakriti are concerned. But we can use this apprehension and comprehension as a kind of, sort of basis of understanding subjective and objective.
Okay, that was very nice.
Is there a priority between when you are looking at any experience, when you are looking or trying to understand the
Sita, world? Can you be a little louder?
Yes. When you are looking at reality, is there a gradation? Even though those two are complementary, necessary. Reality is subjective and both objective. Basically, is there a priority between these two? Like, if you are looking at world, is the suggestion here is that subjective world reality is more primordial than the objective one? Is there an indication? Is there a direct indication here saying that?
We may say that they have to coexist if there is to be any manifestation. But in terms of priority, we can only say that without the subjective, we cannot come to any knowledge. See, it's the knower, right? So we cannot arrive at knowledge without the subjective. But then without the object or without the objective, there is no object of knowledge. So manifestation becomes completely irrelevant if there aren't the two. And from that point of view, that's why he says over there that it is there are two necessary sides of the manifested reality and of equal value. Now, this giving of greater priority or weight to one or the other is really a preference. And that kind of a preference has led to various ways yogas. But ultimately, only in the integral view, they have to be seen as of having equal value, as he says over here. They are both conterminous. They both appear at the same time. And when we use the term time here, it's actually a sort of a paradoxical way of speaking, because there is no time when they start. But from that a priori point of view, they are both a priori.
Thank you. Meera, can you read the next one?
Yeah, I will write. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Can you be a little louder?
Yeah.
That's fine.
Okay. In fact, subjectivity and objectivity are not independent realities. They depend upon each other. They are the being through consciousness looking at itself as subject on the object, and the same being offering itself to its own consciousness as object to the subject. The more partial view concedes no substantive reality to anything which exists only in the consciousness, or, to put it more accurately, to anything to which the inner consciousness or sense bears testimony, but which the outer physical senses do not provide with a ground or do not substantiate. But the outer senses can bear a reliable evidence only when they refer their version of the object to the consciousness, and that consciousness gives a significance to their report, adds to its externality, its own internal intuitive interpretation, and justifies it by a reasoned adherence. For the evidence of the senses is always by itself imperfect, not altogether reliable, and certainly not final, because it is incomplete and constantly subject to error. Indeed, we have no means of knowing the objective universe except by our subjective consciousness, of which the physical senses themselves are instruments, as the world appears not only to that, but in that, so it is to us. If we deny reality to the evidence of this universal witness for subjective or for supraphysical objectivities, there is no sufficient reason to concede reality to its evidence for physical objectivities. If the inner or the supraphysical objects of consciousness are unreal, the objective physical universe has also every chance of being unreal. In each case, understanding, discrimination, verification are necessary. But the subjective and the supraphysical must have another method of verification than that which we apply successfully to the physical and external objective. Subjective experience cannot be referred to the evidence of the external senses. It has its own standards of seeing and its inner method of verification. So also the supraphysical realities, by their very nature, cannot be referred to the judgment of the physical or sense mind, except when they project themselves into the physical. And even then, that judgment is often incompetent or subject to caution. They can only be verified by other senses and by a method of scrutiny and affirmation, which is applicable to their own reality, their own nature. Should I stop here?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, in this wonderful paragraph, these paragraphs, Sri Aurobindo is rounding up all his conceptions, the subjective and objective conceptions, and are reaching us towards an integral viewpoint, viewpoint of being as the integral being. He also at the same time is giving us certain practical directions towards our own existence as collective beings, as human beings. And so here in this particular paragraph, he is pointing out the equality and the coexistence, dependent coexistence of the object and the subject. That's how he begins that. And then as he goes on, he points out that, you know, because he's trying to, as you see as we go on in this paragraph, correct the over insistence on the object by pointing out that the object exists to us really within ourselves. This is a point he has made earlier too. That's why he says over there that this we could never know the object without the subject. Indeed, we have no means of knowing the objective universe except by our subjective consciousness, of which the physical themselves, senses themselves, are instruments. So here he's actually including within the subjective being, within Purusha, if you want to call it, not only just the witness outside of the instrumentation of nature and mind, but the mental instruments, the senses. As the world appears not only to that, but in that, so it is to us. So the world appears in our consciousness, not merely to our consciousness, because that's the important point he's making over there, that indeed we are seeing a world outside us, but we are actually seeing it inside ourselves. And this seeing inside is not merely a seeing, but a giving account, as he says, a giving of report, an interpretation. And we can see exactly how that happens, because our reception of the objective world, even with our external senses, is one in which we actually try to come to a consensus about what we are seeing. or sensing. That, in a sense, we can agree about the basic shapes, colors, sensory properties of the world outside us. But we are not satisfied with that, because that is not enough of an interpretation of world to our own mentalities, even as a collective race of human beings. We have to make inferences. We have to connect these observations. We have to give an account of how they relate to each other. And that already brings us into a realm of interpretation that often transcends our objective seeing. We come up with the notion that the world goes around the sun rather than the sun goes around the world. And similarly, we come up with a variety of world pictures or objective pictures that we derive as a race of humans that depend on mental operations upon the subjective, upon the objects of our subjectivity. And finally, even that is not enough. It doesn't satisfy enough, because we find no meaning, as it were. The realm of meaning goes deeper, and it strikes a chord where everything starts being seen as symbols. So the symbolic nature of the objective world brings us, in a sense, closer to the realm of meaning, where we start recognizing the fact that something beyond subject and object is presenting its self images to itself. And these kind of properties of the world mean nothing except for a deep subjectivity which transcends the object. So here, these are Sri Aurobindo's ways of leading us into what one might call a consideration or an openness to what he could call a subjective science. That it is not enough for us to take this objective world of the external senses as the world that we consider to share and come to a universal consensus about, a consensus of meaning, but that it's important for us to open our consensual consciousness as a human race to the object of supraphysical experience. If we deny reality to the evidence of this universal witness, this is how he puts it, for subjective or for supraphysical objectivities, there is no sufficient reason to concede reality to its evidence for physical objectivities. If the inner or the supraphysical objects of consciousness are unreal, the objective physical universe has also every chance of being unreal. In each case, understanding, discrimination, verification are necessary. But the subjective and the supraphysical must have another method of verification, that which we apply successfully to the physical and external objective. Subjective experience cannot be referred to the evidence of the external senses. It has its own standards of seeing and its inner method of verification. And here we go into the whole notion of even turning that upon the objective world. And as I was saying, and it's not enough to just see shapes, forms, and colors, but to interpret them. And in that interpretation, we go deeper and deeper to a point where we see whatever our experience is, firstly in terms of symbolic representations of the divine, and even in these symbolic representations, darshanas, complete coherent pictures of self-presentation and self-manifestation. That is ultimately the supramental rationality, arriving at a kind of knowledge of inner reality through subjective experience, but verified through a variety of steps to make sure that what one is getting at is not impure or not something conditioned by the lower forms of knowledge. So that's why he says subjective experience cannot be referred to the evidence of the external senses. It has its own standards of seeing and its inner method of verification. This is the inner science of yoga. So also supraphysical realities by their very nature cannot be referred to the judgment of the physical or sense mind except when they project themselves into the physical. And even then, that judgment is often incompetent or subject to caution. They can only be verified by other senses and by a method of scrutiny and affirmation which is applicable to their own reality, their own nature.
So, Devashishda, is such a subjective seeing of the darshanas, is that a digital state or is that a progressive state that we attain over time? Or is it more something of you keep aspiring and at a certain time some door opens and you are into a different world?
Actually, this question that you asked. Hello?
Yeah.
Yes, we are there. What is that? Prasun Kumar hosted Kabhi Kabhi.
Hello?
Hello, who's there?
Something went wrong with this thing.
He's calling, Prasun Kumar.
Who's there?
Hello?
Yeah?
Hello, yeah.
Okay, we'll wait a second.
Yeah.
Just stop the recording so that we can talk.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. We're there.
Sita, Dr. Day is trying to get into this conference.
Okay.
His ID is prasoon.kumar. Do you want to let him in?
Oh, shoot.
And he got online, he got online, so he tried to ping me and the Bajista. So we got online.
Hello, sorry about that. I got called by Dr. Day, who's trying to get in. But to return to the question that Shyam asked, Shyam, this question that you asked about whether it's a you use the term digital or something that grows. It's a very old debate in not only Indian yoga but in variety of yogas. It's called the sudden enlightenment and the gradualist debate. And can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Can I be heard?
Yes, you can be. I can hear you.
Okay. Yes, Sita, it's Prasoon.kumar, yes. Hello?
I did not find Prasoon.kumar.
Just one moment.
What do you think? Is it gradual? What? Oh, sorry. What? Both gradual and sudden are the same.
Sita, it is so prasoon as in P-R-A-S-U-N.
Yeah.
Okay.
I need salt water. Salt hot water.
He's there. Prasun Kumar is in. It's ringing.
Sitaram. Namaste, Prasanda.
Namaste.
you are in the conference, yes.
Here online, yeah.
Yes.
I have Sitaram here. I have Devashish. I have Keka. Keka, are you there?
Yeah. Keka?
Yes, yes. Yeah, Keka. Actually, I'm muting my microphone, that's why.
Okay. All right. Lopa is there. Mira there. Okay. I do not know who Mira is.
Okay, hi. I'm in Sunnyvale.
You're in Sunnyvale?
Yeah.
Okay, Dr. Day.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, what happens is that because there's a lot of feedback problem, when you speak, then only you keep your mic. Otherwise, you see a small mic symbol at the bottom of your window.
Yeah.
If you click on that, it will mute the mic. So
no, I didn't click that.
Whenever somebody else is talking, you mute the mic, and when you talk, you demute the mic.
Oh, so when I talk, I will mute the mic.
No, you don't mute it when you talk. You mute it when anybody else talks.
But I'm talking, you are talking.
Yeah, now it's fine. Now it's fine. But when you're not talking, then you mute it.
When I'm not talking, then I mute it.
Yes.
Okay. Now, have you started the live divine?
Yeah, we have started. We are in the middle. I'm answering a question right now.
Which page is,
My book doesn't have the right page. So somebody else will have to tell Dr. Dale the page numbers where we are.
648.
Actually, in the newer version, I think it's 676.
Yes. It is newer version,
676. Let me see. 7676. And it's at the middle of the book is that equation can only be found. Is that correct? Hello?
It's actually the chapter Reality and the Integral Knowledge, Dr. Day.
No. The aim of life.
Yeah, that means you have an older version. So
648. 648 is the page.
648, okay. Okay. Life Divine Reality and the Integral Knowledge. Okay. I'm ready.
So, Shyam, the question was about this gradualist and sudden enlightenment ideas. And there is a reality or a truth to both of them. And the truth is basically that when we are talking about different ranges of consciousness, one can suddenly rise into a different consciousness. This is almost in the form of what one calls in modern parlance a quantum leap. And you know, you have a different experience. The experience of being changes. But to get into this kind of a state for a sudden small period of time is an experience. It's not a realization. A realization is the stabilization of this kind of a consciousness in one's ordinary state. And for that, a gradual preparation is necessary. A preparation of the consciousness.
We have stopped hearing you, actually.
I don't have to be objective.
Oh.